Welcome to the ClassCast podcast. I'm your host, Ryan Tibbins. Today, we'll be speaking with Dr. Matthew Rhodes, who is a wonderful Twitter personality, researcher, writer, and specifically the author of Navigating the Toggled Term, Preparing Secondary Education for Navigating Fall 2020 and Beyond. Matt also has another book that is going into publication soon we'll talk about. And I thought that this would be a great opportunity to both help him promote his work, but maybe more importantly to the listeners, to get some people some more ideas and some research-based concepts and strategies as we think about what's going to happen as schools sort of shift between in-person and online back and forth, which is, I don't know, Matt, you know more than I do, but I think we're going to see a lot more of that through the spring than we've already seen in the fall. And so maybe this is a very important conversation. How are you doing? And am I right about that?
Yeah, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. Yeah, so we're in the midst of COVID raging in the United States, and a lot of schools are planning on, just for example, a number of schools throughout the entire country just flipped completely to online for the last 2 weeks rolling into winter break. And then we do have schools on the West Coast that are planning on going in person in January, but with over 50,000 cases, for example, in California, I don't think that's going to happen. And we'll be still online, or we'll see just more, depending on where you're at in the country, depending on where, you know, the rate of positivity rates. We're going to see just, you know, a lot of switching from in person to online because of just the community spread is everywhere. And I think that this will be something that's going to continue until at least the late spring, until we'll see a little bit more stability. But who knows at this point with where COVID is at this point in the United States.
Yeah. And some of this is going to be obviously a regional discussion. You know, maybe one of the best things about, you know, in the last year, I've gotten more active on Twitter. And one of the best things about it is hearing from people all over the country, you know, all over the world, and you realize like how localized some of these decisions are. So even though the concept of education is a big one, and it's, I mean, essentially universal, the way it actually plays out and some of the methods we're going to use to say navigate a pandemic will be very different from place to place. So you mentioned California. Where do you work? Like what part of California are you in?
So I live in San Diego, California, but I work in North County, San Diego, at a secondary school, but I'm also at San Diego State University for my professor duties with lecturing on ed tech, as well as I also supervise teacher candidates. So I see the university as well as the secondary K-12 education perspective in my day-to-day work. So
right. Yeah. And you know, I think people, whether it's fair or not, maybe have held up California as an example, one of the places that have shut down a little more, been a little tighter on things. I'm in Northern Virginia, and I think some of the counties have actually probably regulated a little better than the state overall. But you know, the governor's caught a lot of grief here for some of the shutdowns, or maybe now some people are upset we're not shutting down. And you know, you talk to somebody in Florida, and they're like, "Oh no, everybody's in school, and you know, nobody wears a mask and whatever." And so it's such a different conversation place to place. But in the end, the basic conditions still exists everywhere. You know, we have people getting sick. We're trying to keep students and the faculty safe. And then we've got to figure out, you know, how do we best do that? And I think there are a lot of good arguments to be made for being in school as much as you can. So I've been in my school two times since March, like since the March, whatever, 11th, you know, when everything shut down, March 12th, I've been in the building twice. That being said, they have a plan that we're all going back in January, you know, and based on the way numbers are, I don't think it's going to happen, but I don't have a crystal ball for it. You know, I have friends who have been in person the whole time. Yeah, honestly, I think we missed an opportunity. Like if we wanted to be in person, they should have started the year in person when the weather was warmer, you can have the windows open, numbers were down. And then right around Thanksgiving, we all should have kicked to online. But I think a lot of places, including where I work, did the reverse of it. And in part, the reason to go back is a lot of people are losing patience with the online. Like there's a lot of frustrated parents, and that's understandable. But what's your sense? And since this is a little bit more your specialty, you've been tracking sort of what the schools are doing. I know you shared, I didn't write down the URL. You shared a great website with me that had like the national map, and it shows, you know, our schools online, in person, what have they done? What is your sense of that overall?
So it's really interesting. It's like we've been talking about, it's regional, but it's more metro coastal places are online versus more rural suburban are more like hybrid or fully in person. But that has changed over the course of this fall. What's great is It's called MCH Strategic Data. They put together basically all the different types of teaching, well, instructional models that are being utilized in the United States. They narrowed it down to online, hybrid, and then just in person with safety precautions. And essentially, if you look at the 2020 electoral map, it breaks down pretty much the same as where we're online versus when we're fully in person versus where we're hybrid. So it's interesting to see that breakdown. But we've seen since the beginning of the school year more obviously in-person hybrid, and then that shifted more to more online instruction throughout the semester as it's gone cooler out in most places.
Yeah. So definitely seen the shift and with weather, with, you know, maybe family gatherings and things with the holidays. My friend and coworker, Jim Dunning, who I think is still the only person that's been on the podcast twice. He regularly points out that the decision to be in person or online has probably more to do with who you vote for than the actual, you know, metrics, the health metrics in the area. And I was like, I don't know if it has more to do, but I will give you that it has as much to do, you know. And so there's just so many factors at play here, and people feel so differently about this. Before we get into maybe how we can make this work better, let's talk about just real quick, how do you sort of feel about school? Obviously, you have a doctorate, so I'm assuming you're cool with school. But as a student, what kind of student were you? What did you like or dislike as you went through K through 12 and then into higher ed? How was that for you?
Yeah, so starting off in my educational experiences, I really struggled in school. I struggled with math, reading, writing. But fortunately, I had a really good teacher in fourth grade, and she really put a lot of effort into, you know, who I am and my strengths. And fortunately, you know, something clicked and I was able to do quite well in my schooling through K-12, you know, traditional high school AP classes, and then moving into undergrad. I took a little, before I got into education, a pit stop in law school, did not particularly like it. Didn't like studying 75 hours a week and just going to school and studying for that much time. And then just like, all right, I'm getting like B's and this is miserable. So definitely did not like the law school experience in my education. But then when I got my master's and teaching credentials and then my doctorate, enjoyed every minute of it, because I feel like what I was doing in those programs, I was doing every single day with kids. So that definitely made it seem like it's worthwhile. But I think also too, is that in terms of my education, is that I'm trying to learn new things every day. I think just the moment that I started teaching, I'm doing things completely different as I'm doing now versus what I learned getting my credentials. It's really outdated, and it, you know, hasn't been a whole lot of time in terms of just the context of an entire career. So it's just, I feel like education in general just taught me to be a lifelong learner, and just teaching me a lot of, and it's not even really the academic skills, it's more like the executive function soft skills that's kind of taught me to like learn how to study, learn how to be on time, learn how to schedule your time, learning how to just follow through. I feel like those things have taught me to be a better just learner in general. So that's just a little bit about my educational experience. It's been a lot of fun. I think just the most worthwhile experiences were actually being immersed in like real life situations. I traveled to China for part of my doctoral program, visited a ton of schools, got to meet and talk to people, got to see what they're doing. And those types of just being immersed in just a different place or a different educational setting is something that I feel like really benefited me. And that continues to be something that I like to do as an educator, just see what other people are doing and just kind of picking and choosing what I want to integrate into my own practice. So
that's awesome. And that's, you know, sort of what you said at the end there. I mean, that's half the reason that this podcast is set up like it is, because I get to hear from a lot of different people. And so I'm like, you know, as long as I'm learning something, then that was still, you know, that was a good use of my time. And then try to spread, you know, useful stuff to other people. Thinking about that idea where you said, you know, the things that you learned, say undergrad or getting your original teaching credentials, is now outdated. If we think about, like, I know what you mean, but I also balk at that in part, because I think that, like, when I think back on my high school experience, not all, but at least two of the best classes I took in high school, then probably just the best classes overall, like they were better than some of my college classes, were very kind of old school, but with little bits of things we're still doing. So like I had this advanced biology, it was like a human anatomy class. There was a test like every week, every 2 weeks. And the teacher basically taught us all these study skills, but you had to memorize every bone in the body and three quarters of the muscles and like all this stuff. But then there were labs. So there's a lot of hands-on and it was still sort of project-based, but there was still a ton of this sort of rote memorization and things like that. And I, in retrospect, it was one of the best classes I ever took because I learned both a lot about the body, but I learned about learning. I now think about trying to run a class like that guy did, you know, now. And I think he'd get raked over the coals. Like the parents would freak out, administrators wouldn't like it. And I don't know that it's ineffective. So when you say like the strategies that you learned or used early in your career, and you now see them as being a little outdated, or what causes that? Like in your mind, as someone who's studying education, what drives the rate of change in that pedagogy?
So it necessarily is not the change of pedagogy. It's just how I'm doing it. How am I integrating like technology to drive those strategies? So it's like a partner turn and share. I'm not using just like a basic in-person anymore. I'm doing breakout rooms. They're sharing a Pear Deck slide. They're sharing a Google Doc, and they're providing evidence on both sides of whether they were talking about an argument or we're doing a number talk. It's something like that nature. So it's not necessarily like the strategy is like super old and outdated. It's just the way that I'm doing it.
So like delivery method.
Yeah. The delivery method is completely changed. Yeah. That's probably where I'm trying to go with it.
Yeah, no. And I mean, I think that's, you know, fair in general, and especially right now. You know, I always said, you know, it's funny that I'm now doing everything online and actually getting surprisingly comfortable with it, because right up until, you know, a week before school shut down, I was still making the argument, and I would still make this argument, but I could teach kids at least the skills that they need coming from the English class. If you just gave me a weekly newspaper and pens and paper, like you need to read, you need to write, we need to talk about it. I'll scour the thing to find something that's well-written. I can teach you, you know, some rhetorical strategies or whatever. And that's still true. I can still do that. But I have a million more tools. And now I've been put in a situation where I really have an incentive to use them. Like, it's not just the, hey, it'd be nice to work this into class. Like, now I have to work that into class because I can't hand things out the way I used to. In terms of changing delivery, say, as we've gone online, how much of that do you think is going to stick? You know, because I know people love the term blended learning, and I think it's maybe now going to be something that is legitimately practiced in more schools, but how much of this is going to stick around in 5 years?
Well, I think that so in the book, I talk about the online instructional infrastructure. It is a learning management system, a virtual like video type platform like Zoom, Microsoft Teams, Google Meet, content creation tools like Microsoft 365, Google Workspace, and then like collaborative engagement tools. You could say like Pear Deck or Nearpod or Flipgrid. I'm just going through the mainstream one, but there's hundreds of these that can fall into like engagement type tools and then collaborative based tools. And this makes up what I call the online instructional infrastructure. And I don't think that, you know, after this crisis, I think that most teachers will be using components of this online instructional infrastructure where most of the content is going to be digital versus paper. I mean, I think that we will have that pushback where probably some classes will have elements of paper and pencils still being available. But I think probably for the most part, most people will have at least 75 to 90% of their class within in the digital realm using tools to help them deliver instruction. I mean, I think that, I mean, if we're looking at the workforce now for teachers, I think that as more and more continue to retire, I mean, there's, and also as well as teachers, you know, building, you know, their toolkit and using these tools after this year, I mean, it's, I don't think many people will want to go back completely unless you feel like you are just super comfortable and feel like these tools are ineffective. So I think that there will be a little bit of pushback, but I think we're going to see after maybe like 2 to 3 years that it, after that initial pushback, it's just going to completely just drastically shift to, by the end of the decade, it's going to, I mean, the way that we are providing instruction will be, I think, 100% digital, and that's going to be the future of K-12 and higher ed.
Yeah. And you're right. And I keep using this analogy when talking to coworkers, but you know, it's like when you stretch a rubber band out, you know, and if you just stretch and let go and stretch and let go, you know, it maintains that elasticity. But the longer we stay online and the more time people are forced to use these digital tools. And I don't mean forced by their boss. Like, this isn't the superintendent says you have to use it. You're forced to be resourceful and use what you have access to. Like, the longer you hold it, that'll last. Like, you're not snapping back to the way things were, you know? And for me, I think it's in overall, it's going to be a good thing. Now, I teach, you know, AP English. As long as that's going to be a pencil and paper test, kids are still going to have to be writing and annotating pencil and paper. And I don't think that that's a bad thing, but a lot of the other things we're doing, you know, yeah, some of this isn't going back. I had a friend who, geez, it was probably 7 or 8 years ago, did a paperless classroom, and it was before we were one-to-one. Now, I do work in a affluent area, so most kids could bring in a device or at least had a phone to pull up PDFs and stuff. He did a paperless classroom, and he said after about the first 3 months, kids figured it out. He figured it out, and it was good. And he did that, and that was a while ago, you know. And now I'm thinking, like, man, if he could have pulled it off then, there's really no reason anybody couldn't do it now, you know? Yeah. And so I think some of that change is coming in terms of, you know, as you listed off all of these different digital tools. And as you said, there are hundreds of them. I was talking with a friend of mine who works for, you know, a major ed tech company. And he sort of predicted, he didn't go into any details, but he predicted that over the next year, there's going to be this massive shift because there's so many startups, there's so many schools using different things. And he said what he's predicting is, you know, rattle off your four or five biggest ed tech companies, you know, your Pearson, Instructure, you know, PowerSchool, like a few others. And he said basically his prediction is that they're going to buy up everything. They're going to consolidate it, build it into the learning management systems they have. And he goes, so everyone's going to be using it, but everyone's going to be using fewer tools, like Walmart's going to come to town kind of deal. And so do you have a sense that, and I'm asking you not necessarily because I don't know if you've had that conversation, but you're more familiar with more of these tools than I am. Do you have the sense that that's coming? Like, are we going to see a consolidation and a restructuring?
Yeah, I see that happening. I mean, it makes sense. I mean, if you are an ed tech company startup, I mean, you're going to want to cash in while it's hot, right? So yeah, I do think that probably by 2022, 2023, we'll see more of that consolidation. I don't know if it will be as big as you're saying, but I do think that there's going to be a lot more integrations of these smaller little tools within the learning management systems. So whether that is just through consolidation or, for example, PowerSchool just builds them in, they just have the infrastructure anyways, just to build in these additional tools and just say to other, these smaller companies, well, we already have built this in, so we don't really need you anymore. So we don't need to buy you. So, I mean, that could be another way of going as well.
And squeeze them out. So when you're thinking about the tools that you use most often with your high school students, right? You're a high school special education teacher, right? What are just a few of the tools that you like? Like, not that you have to endorse it to everyone, just stuff that you use and you feel like is working really well for you.
Yeah. So, I mean, I feel like I know about like 35 to 40 tools pretty well, but I have the attitude of think less is more, especially with, you know, teaching any sort of class, because you want to develop routines with these tools, as well as you want to implement really good strategies with the tools to amplify them. So if you're using like 10, 12 tools, that's not really going to be sufficient. It's not going to be good for you. It's not going to be good for your students. So I generally use like about 3 to 5. So my daily learning management system for my school district is Google Classroom. I have to use it. I'm not sure it's the best platform, but unfortunately, I have to use it. And I use Pear Deck because I'm teaching math this year. A lot of just interactive whiteboards, and I'm able to give feedback. I have instructional aides, my co-teachers, and they're giving kids instant feedback along with we're going. We use Zoom as our platform, so I always have my iPad out, and I'm always annotating with my iPad onto the different screens for my students. And I forgot to mention that for my learning management system, I integrate Seesaw and Google Classroom together, because Seesaw, I think, is more multimodal in terms of students are able to do a lot more on Seesaw for some types of tasks and assignments versus Google Classroom, especially in math. And also, it's just a lot easier to use. I think the usability is easier because it's like basically 2 or 3 clicks versus Google Classroom. I think for certain things that you're doing, it's about 4 to 5. So I like that as well. And then I'm using like Edpuzzle a lot for like asynchronous front loading content, especially in math, like a math concept before we go over it. I'm also using Flipgrid for social emotional learning as well as number talks, and using Google Workspace for just my content creation. And that's pretty much it for right now. I'm keeping it to about those five or six that I'm using every single day. Definitely ventured with some other tools just for my everyday uses, but I'm trying to just keep it simple so that I don't overwhelm my students and myself by just trying to do too much at one time.
That's awesome. And it's a good list. I've heard of all of them. I've only used a couple. I've been saying for years that my biggest two professional goals are to slow down. Like I get excited and then we sort of run through things. And it's in English class, you can kind of do it because you're always just building literacy and critical thinking. Like read, think, write, and speak. Like that's my thing. I describe every one of my classes. You read, you think, you write, you speak. You usually do it in that order. So whether I go fast or I go slow, in the end, we're always doing the same stuff. It's just with a new text. So in English, the speed doesn't maybe hurt the way it would in a math class or something like that. That being said, I've always said, for years I've been saying I'm going to slow down and really dig in deeper, give kids time to sort of digest the material. And now I'm actually doing it, right? And then the other thing is to provide faster feedback. And so some of these tools are actually allowing for the students to do some creative stuff and have actually helped me. I still have a long way to go. I'll be honest, but they're working in that direction, and so I'm actually looking at second semester. We've had Pear Deck, but I hadn't really had time to play with it. And I think my division just got a subscription for everybody to Nearpod. And so I think, I've got to look because from what I understand, very similar, different functions in both. And I'm like, I have some stuff that we do in the AP classes where they read something and I have a PowerPoint that sort of leads back through the here's the key points. We talk it out. But it's really hard sometimes to get a really good discussion going when everybody's online and half of them have their cameras off and whatever. So some of these tools can be useful in those capacities. And I think you're right, sort of keeping the number to something manageable, use each one with purpose is good. In terms of what you studied when you got your doctorate, how much of that was based on ed tech versus the concepts of blended learning overall versus, I know you're a big data guy, and so we're sort of working in that direction, but how much of this is stuff that you've done out of personal curiosity in your daily job versus how much of this is formal education for you?
So you'd mentioned a paperless class a few moments ago, and I've been doing that since the beginning of my teaching career. I just jumped in and started going pretty much paperless, teaching English and social science. And I mean, probably the first year about 90% paperless, and then I got to about 100% once all the devices were given to us. But I would say that the ed tech has always kind of been interrelated with the data, because data, you create data from using the ed tech, and there's a lot of opportunities for us to use the data from the tech to help drive our instruction. And I think that we live in an age of formative assessment. We can do formative assessment just at any moment and get that data, and then personalize our instruction for students based on where they're at and give them that instant feedback, which is huge. I would say that they're kind of intertwined, because like I just mentioned, is that ed tech and data, I mean, you're producing data when you're doing actions on an ed tech tool. So really my research relates to the efficacy of school leaders and teachers using that data to drive their instruction, or to basically use that data to help guide them and make decisions for at the instructional level and then the organizational level. And I'm a big proponent of like data literacy, especially with technology literacy, because without understanding both realms, you're missing out on a big piece of the puzzle. So I think that both are really truly interrelated in just my day-to-day, and then just my research interests kind of came together. And I think now more than ever, they're just getting more important as we're continuing to immerse ourselves in these digital environments.
So let's do data talk kind of quickly here, because I'm in this weird spot where, I'm not going to claim to be an expert on data analysis, but I've never sat in a meeting where someone handed me a chart or handed me something where I couldn't figure it out. Like I did, So I'm like, I'm good enough that in most cases I can figure out what we're looking at and figure out, how to make some of this actionable. I also don't know that I ever feel like I'm fully equipped to gather the data in effective ways. And I had a talk with, I think it was maybe talking with Craig Randall, who he's got a whole observation sort of thing that he's promoting. And we had this talk about, you know, how do you use the data to improve your teaching? And he talked about action research, which is something that I'd learned about and done a little bit in college, which was a good idea. It was silly implementing it then, but I'm of the opinion that I would love people to hand me as much useful data as I can get about my students, about my teaching, about whatever else. I also don't feel great about having to get a lot of the data myself because it feels like an added burden. Like it's another thing for me to do. And while I know it's very useful, the time it takes for me to sort of aggregate, disaggregate, like go through all of this stuff. And then I'm still looking at essays that I haven't graded, even though they were written 3 weeks ago, you know? So in your perspective, what's the right way to do that? Like, should individual teachers be gathering and assessing their own data? Should there just be a data person in the administration of each school where that's their job? And they, you know, how does that work best? Because I think younger teachers are more open to it on average, I'm generalizing, than older teachers, but I still don't know if everyone has the tools to really do it themselves. So like, how do we implement?
Yeah. So I think it's twofold, like you mentioned. So I think that first you need to assess the data literacy of your teachers and staff, because first, you know, do they understand that when you're using Pear Deck or Flipgrid or any of these tools, you can just basically create a, just generate a report, and it generates a report that you can look at a spreadsheet and look at the data that way. Or a lot of these tools now have data visualizations or charts you can just look at on the platform and just see kind of that visualization of these trends that are occurring. Like say, for example, if you're using like a tool like GoFormative for a quiz or test, or like quizzes or even Kahoot, I mean, you can just right after a quiz, you can see like directly like, okay, students got this question incorrect, or some of the most answers that they got incorrect were X, Y, Z. And then you can go back real quickly and just looking at the visualization, just make that decision quickly to say, hey, we need to review these concepts. Also, there can be aligned to different standards where you can say like, hey, you know, this just from getting these problems incorrect or getting them right, we can say, hey, we're achieving this standard or not. So we need to possibly go back and look at the standard again. You can also break it down by groups by looking at these visualizations as well as exporting it over to a spreadsheet. And I really think that the need is one with the exporting the data to the spreadsheet and looking at that data there and looking at it quickly and just making some quick charts and analyzing those charts. Also just understanding what these, how to access the data visualizations on the tools themselves and just understanding like what they mean and how we can take that, you know, real-time data or just from that assessment data really quickly and say like, hey, I need to do X, Y, Z, these actionable steps so that I can improve my instruction for all my students or different groups of students.
So like, I'm on board with all of that, except I don't want to do it. Right. I love having access to it. And by the way, like, you know, I teach, this year I have a 12th grade class, but I've taught 11th grade, which in Virginia is the only year they do the state standardized test. Like we have the SOL standard of learning test. They do a reading test and a writing test. And so I've been teaching that since my third year teaching, I think, and sort of became my bread and butter because I could teach a class that kids mostly like, and we talk a lot about real world stuff and, you know, there's a lot of philosophy in it and really get them thinking. But in the end, I get really good scores. You know, and I'm one of the only teachers in my department who I think, I don't want to say only teachers, but I want to look at the data from the test. Like I want to, not that I want to sit and pore over it for hours, but it's not just like, yeah, there's the scores. I want to see like where they're scoring well, where they're scoring poorly. That informs what I'm going to do the following year. For actual, say, formative assessments and say classroom-based stuff where the teacher's creating it, you pointed out, you know, you sort of slipped in there that some of that can be aligned to standards. That's the piece where for me, it gets really difficult because as you're designing an assessment to actually assess it according to each individual standard, or if I'm doing an essay, I have to then like think about how do I create a rubric that's based on the standards to get data that's useful. Because in the end, that's data that's useful to me, but sometimes a simpler rubric that sort of generalizes skills is actually more effective feedback to the students, right? Students don't necessarily need to see the standards in that, but the teacher does. Do you think that this is a matter of training teachers to create those kinds of assessments? Like, should we just be thinking this way all the time?
Yeah.
Or is that, I know in a lot of places that comes down as a top-down thing. Somebody designs an assessment. We use it as a common assessment across a grade level, across a whole county. and then it's done and the data is there. But then you tend to have teachers push back a lot because they say, well, that doesn't reflect how I taught it, or, you know, the terminology of my classroom, et cetera. Is it really about empowering the teachers to learn to do this themselves? Or do you think the easy implementation is just have someone else make it for them? You know, like I said, because when I get the data from my state tests, hey, that's great because someone else did it for me. But if I was really, you know, if I was a little more consistent, I should be doing that myself on every assessment. Is that a teacher responsibility? Is that something we should be doing, or we will be doing in the near future?
Yeah, I think since, like I said, we live in an age of formative assessment, and these tools now have the ability to really, you can create assessments really quickly on a lot of these platforms where it'll automatically give you the standard that aligns to these various types of questions. And once you get the results, you can really make that determination of whether you met that standard or not. And you can do this really quite easily. It can take me about 5 minutes to create a formative assessment with these platforms that align to the standard. And I think that just teaching teachers how to do it and doing it consistently is huge. And I think that that's part of learning these tools, and it's learning that, you know, we need to be actionable with these tools so that we are driving our instruction. So I think that if, for example, districts don't begin focusing on this, you're losing out on a major opportunity, because all these tools have these capabilities and you can put your students in a better position because you are essentially seeing how they're doing. And then you can differentiate, you know, to the different groups of students based on how they're doing versus kind of just looking at the all-encompassing result in like a grade book.
The overall score isn't as informative. Okay. So I don't know if this is a fair comparison, but I'm going to say this. Just, I was talking with some friends a couple nights ago. One of the silver linings of a pandemic is I now spend more time talking to some of my like old friends from high school and college through like video chats than I have since we lived together or something, you know. And one of the guys was talking about his kid's school and blah, blah, blah. And he brought up something about data stuff, and he's some sort of data analyst. I don't know exactly what he does. And I described that my goal as a teacher, I said, it's not necessarily about having kids with the highest grades or lowest grades or whatever else. I say, for me, I think long-term. So it's not, you know, how do they do when they graduate? It's like, you know, let's check in on that person when they're 30 or they're 35. Are they an effective person? Are they relatively happy? Can they take care of themselves and their family? Are they a decent citizen? Like, if most of my students are doing those things, then I feel like I've done my job saying, hey, your kid scored, you know, 27 points higher on average on the SAT. Like, that's nice, but that's not, I don't think that, you know, that's not an end goal. That's still a step to something else. And so I use the term WAR, like from baseball analytics. So like, I want wins above replacement. Like, that's when I get my teacher evaluation, I want to know how many wins, quote unquote, above the average teacher did I provide? And where can I do that better? I mean, maybe I'm oversimplifying. Are we kind of talking about like moneyballing education a little bit? Like, you know, if anybody's read or seen Moneyball, like the way you're talking about data makes me think like, hey, we could be making a lot more effective and efficient decisions if we use the information that's already available to us.
Yeah, essentially we are in the Moneyball age of education. I think we're getting to that precipice that, you know, if we're able to use the data that we're collecting, because we're collecting so much data from all these tools. And if we're not using it, then we're not putting ourselves as instructors and our students in the best positions to learn. And I think that just with the ability to use these analytics is that we can really, you know, put ourselves as teachers in positions to provide instruction that is going to benefit students that need the most support, and also the students that need that additional extension activity beyond what we're doing. So I think that, I was just thinking of when you're just talking the last couple minutes of Moneyball, because I watched it actually just recently again, and I'm just like, yeah, we're totally doing this, but you know, I think that you're going to eventually go to scale. And I've talked a little bit about with other educators the notion of like data literacy is also technological literacy needs to be really incorporated within not only K-12, but also within teacher education programs. I mean, that's where school education programs need to go. If they do not do that, they're not going to be putting the next generation of teachers in the positions for them to be successful with the tools that they have at their disposal.
Yeah, you know, not to beat on the baseball analogy too bad, but I always think back to two seasons ago, there's this great clip you can find on YouTube where the announcer's saying, like, I can't believe they made this shift in the field. Everybody stand on this side. Why would anybody stand there? That's insane. And then the guy hit the ball like directly at like the shortstop was standing in left field or something, and he didn't even move. He just put his glove up and he caught it. And if you use that as the analogy for school, like maybe that makes baseball more or less entertaining. But our job in school isn't entertaining. Like if every one of those balls student, like you don't want to let any of them sneak through. So if you have the data that can sort of put kids in the right places or help teachers focus in the right places, then it's hard to argue against it. Like it does represent a big change in what we do. But if in the end we have a better outcome, then, you know, I don't know why we wouldn't do it. And as you point out, maybe we have the tools for it. As we think about, you know, using the data and using the tools, you wrote a book called Navigating the Toggled Term. And so I know we need to address what we mean by toggling, but just as a segue from the data, how did your recommendations in the book, how have they been informed by your data background or by your previous use of the technology? Because I mean, that's what a lot of this is about, is how do we navigate the current, you know, pandemic dynamics? How much of the data literacy piece is important in determining what are the most effective strategies for online and for hybrid?
Yeah. So when we're thinking about, navigating the toggle term, is essentially my entire career, when I went paperless, I've been doing blended learning, essentially practicing blended learning in a variety of different ways, like station rotation, flipped classroom, all these different styles of blended learning while I was in person. So I've been practicing this stuff for a while. Even though I wasn't initially, when I was first doing it, really thinking about what I actually was doing in terms of when I was reading literature from like Catelyn Tucker, for example, and just her ideas of like what blended learning looks like. And really when the pandemic hit, I'm like, okay, so we're really going to be in a position where everything's going to have to be digital, whether we're online or in person in some extent, because you can't touch anything, you can't really do anything in a socially distanced classroom. So you're essentially going to be all digital, and you're going to have to keep everything digital. And we're going to have to be using these blended learning strategies, especially if we go into, you know, hybrid like schedules, because for the reasons that I just stated, you can't touch anything besides your device, and really ways for you to interact and communicate with your teacher and student in online as well as in-person settings is going to be through your device and through the tools that you're using. So really developing instructional models that can best benefit teachers and students within these scenarios is the premise of the book. And it's also really the premise of my future book, but it's also putting it all into action. It's like, how do we actually put like blended learning or putting blended learning strategies within an online setting as well? So I'm trying to argue that all these things are interchangeable. So regardless of whether you're online, you can use a blended learning strategy like flip classroom. You can do that in an in-person setting by flipping the classroom as well. You could also use a blended learning strategy like station rotation in online and in in-person settings, just depending on how you want to use it. So my books talk about how to put that into action and makes basically instruction possible anywhere at any time. And in a flip of the hat, you can change basically how you are conducting your class by incorporating these models of blended learning in an online or in-person setting. And I also talk a lot about the concurrent and HyFlex, especially in my second book, as basically just an emergency use of a strategy where for about 10 to 14 days, you can have working with students in person as well as online. So it's just showing that education now is just interchangeable. Doesn't matter where you are, as long as you have a device and as long as you have a well thought out plan to implement instructional strategies that amplify the tools you're using within these models to help your students learn, then you're going to be able to toggle at any point of time to, ensure everyone's safety and ensure that learning continues without being stopped.
Yeah. And that's really the situation we're in. And I don't necessarily want to get into the concurrent thing at the moment, but I will just put out there, you know, you say as an emergency response, 10 to 14 days, like my school division's plan is concurrent hybrid for the entire second semester. Like that, it's not a 10-day deal. Like I'm going to have, and because kids could choose online or the hybrid where they come in, you know, a couple days a week, most of my classes, I'm going to have 3 kids in the room and like 20 kids online, and I'm teaching them all at the same time. And I've told them at it. I'm like, look, we're going to have like a little more casual conversation in the classroom, and you guys are probably going to be able to get a little extra help, but I can't like walk up on you and grab a paper or anything. I said, so you're still doing the online class. I want you to understand that, like, I'm limited in how much I can change it for you. And as much as we don't love to admit, like, school is kind of a utilitarian system, you know, greatest good for the greatest number. I'm like, you know, if you're the 3 kids in the room, I'm gonna help you out, but I'm not doubling my planning time for you guys. Like, we got 20 people on the screen still. So we want to talk about the toggling idea, but I want to define 2 terms, and I want you to do it because I think I'm not smart enough to do this right. What is blended learning? And then what do you mean when you say toggle? So like, those are 2 terms that we're using that I don't think everybody's as familiar with as they should be.
So blended learning is basically creating opportunities for your students to learn in an online and in-person setting. So that, or you could also say blended learning is opportunities to create different types of learning for students within an online setting. So for example, let's talk about the flipped classroom model that can be incorporated in online as well as a blended in-person online scenario. So for example, if I'm doing it in an in-person scenario, I'm using the flipped classroom, which is basically taking a lot of the front loading of instruction. So like, I'm teaching my students prior to coming into the class a lot of the major themes relating to the content and skills that we're going to go over. And then when we go into class, we have more of our conversation. We have more of our project-based learning that's taking place. And also with that, and that's the synchronous piece, which is of the flipped classroom model for this in-person online setting. But we can flip it and do the same thing with an online setting. And we can basically provide instruction by front-loading it. And then we can also, synchronously together within an online Zoom meeting, we can have collaborative conversation. We can work together on collaborative projects, et cetera. So that's just one example of how blended learning can be interchangeable within in-person, online, and then just in online settings.
Nice. Yeah. And it was a term that I'd heard thrown around for a little while, and I didn't feel like I had a firm grasp on it. And that's actually one of those things that I think teacher Twitter has been helpful for, because at some point, like last winter, I think I was doing like the blended learning in action or something. It's like a Twitter chat. And I was like, oh, all right. So now like, I really like got a better sense. Like, what are we talking about? And I'm looking at like, oh, well, I already do some of this in lower tech ways. And now I'm finding like, well, the technology, obviously online, I have to do it. So I think that that's a term that I've heard some people sort of balk at, because I think in some teachers' heads, that's a bigger shift. Like, they think it's a bigger deal than maybe it is.
It's not as big as a shift as you think. You're probably doing a lot of the same practices as prior to the pandemic, and, you know, doing things that were asynchronous versus synchronous anyways. You just didn't call them that, but you're doing a lot of that anyways.
And that's where sometimes we trick ourselves into like, you know, thinking we're reinventing the wheel kind of deal. And it's like, no, you're already doing it. You got to tweak 3 pieces, you know, or, you know, add this tool, and it's already done. And I personal opinion here, but I think a lot of times when new ideas or new strategies, new tools are introduced, whether that's through a district level professional development or whatever it may be, I think sometimes that the people who present that information are either so excited about it themselves or are so excited about like justifying their job, since they're not in the classroom, but they're still in education, that sometimes they talk about things like they're so new. And they forget that sometimes the people in the classroom like don't want new things. So it's like the idea is great, but you want to make it sound as simple as you can. Like, you're already doing it. You're just going to make this adjustment. And then people jump on when it's presented as though it's very exciting, but it's very new. I think sometimes we lose people. And that's one of the reasons that sometimes the change is slow is because it always feels like it's such a big change. And maybe it isn't. Now, one thing that I think for most people is a big change is this idea of toggling, right? And I like, you know, I keep using, you know, I keep thinking of it as like the toggle, like flipping a switch and things like that. The title of your first book is Navigating the Toggled Term. And you wrote it, it just came out this year, right? This is summer.
Was July, it over the summer? July 2020. Yeah.
So July 2020. And so you are a combination of a smart person who already had a lot of these ideas, and I think probably also a very fast writer. And so you publish a book, you know, pretty quickly as the pandemic hits. What got you thinking about this idea of toggling? I mean, you know, I guess clarify what we mean by toggling, but at what point did you decide that like this was something you wanted to write, that this is something you had to share?
Yeah. So I was just cruising around Twitter in early April, and I came across an academic by the name of Brian Alexander. He's an education futurist that focuses more on higher ed. And I read one of his blog posts about the notion of toggling and just talking about when schools close down physically, we have the ability now to, you know, just go online temporarily and then go back in person because everything is on this online infrastructure. So I basically thought about his ideas and I was like, okay, for K-12, this is totally possible. And I'm going to look at other research about like blended learning and online instruction, and then really just integrating that into some blog posts. And then initially after that, after a couple of weeks in April, I published a number of blog posts and I was like, okay, there needs to be a book on this because no one's talking about this in terms of like implementation. And I felt that this pandemic was going to last a lot longer than I think people at the time were thinking around March and April. So I really just, I was locked down. I'm teaching online, so I had a lot of extra time besides just...
I got nowhere to go.
So I just ultimately just sat down and wrote the book and just wanted to try and create an opportunity for teachers and school leaders to, you know, just take what I'm trying to say and implement it because I think that it can solve at least some of the instructional problems that we are facing at this point. I mean, it's not going to be... everyone has their own local problems, but I'm trying to find ways for us to, you know, take on these challenges. And I think that a lot of solutions that I provide in my books, can do that.
Yeah. And so I'll use my local example. And I know I mentioned this before, and I think we talked about this right before we started recording, but we were all online through the spring. Been all online the start of the school year. And then they brought back like the students who chose to go hybrid a couple of days a week, K through two, certain special education programs. Then they started to weave in a few extra special education, English language learners, and then a couple of like the hands-on programs that are a Votech school and like a magnet school, like a science magnet school. Right after Thanksgiving, like the timing probably couldn't have been worse. And I don't blame any one person. It's a little bit of, you know, forces converging, but they sent back the rest of elementary school right after Thanksgiving. And it lasted 2 weeks and the local metrics hit and they're like, boom, everybody's back online, you know? And I think what's probably going to happen locally and maybe a lot of places nationally is exactly what you're describing. As we get into the spring, the weather breaks, you know, it's not going to be everybody, but more people will be vaccinated, you know, et cetera. It's going to be easier to get back in person as you get into the end of the school year. But at any given moment, you know, oh, hey, 25 kids and five of the teachers all just tested positive. You know, you got to shut it down for 2 weeks just to figure it out. The ability to make that change and to make it feel seamless, you know, because I just remember in the spring, you know, we shut down. I didn't teach for almost a month. You know, I mean, it was just like, and I was actually kind of pissed about it because I was like, I can do this. Like right now, like I'm not saying it'll be pretty. I'm just saying I can be teaching right now. And we just couldn't get the go ahead because there were concerns about equity and access to you know, and all that's fair. How fast do you think that this can happen? Like I recently heard that there are some places in the country that have like a 24-hour protected period where they switch. If you switch from in-person online or online to in-person, there's 24 hours from the time they announce it to where you can actually begin. So essentially everybody gets a day off to get themselves organized, refocus, et cetera. Do you think that that's reasonable? Or do you think that like with appropriate front loading and training the teachers, like, I mean, can this just happen? Like, hey, Thursday we're going home, Friday we're online. Or do you think that it does take a little transition?
Yeah. So you make a good point. And I think when it comes down to it is that, say, take, for example, the snow day example, you were talking about that on Twitter the other day, and people have been talking about it. It's like, well, I mean, now I think we're in a position if it's a, like, for example, a snow day or a weather incident or, you know, currently now with COVID, I mean, if you have the front loading in it and if you have all the technology in place to just, it could just occur overnight, to be honest, if your class schedule could just completely switch to an online setting. And I think 12 to 24 hours, I mean, for many places at this point seems feasible, but depends on where you're at. I mean, there's all, you know, technology inequities. I mean, it's more of a local issue relating to how long it should take. But I think that if every kid had a device and a teacher was trained to have a learning management system, as well as just a meeting tool like Zoom or Google Meet or Microsoft Teams, it could be, you know, just as a snap of a hat, you know, snap of your fingers, it just could just automatically switch. So, I mean, I think that the training is definitely needed, but I think that, I mean, even after, you know, you could say by the end of 2021, I think that most people would be able to do it pretty quick.
And I agree. I think that a lot of the negative reactions we got to distance learning in the fall, especially, were built on this sort of like everybody sort of scrambled in the spring, and some places were ready, you know. I think it was 2 days after the shutdown. I did a quick episode with a friend of mine who sells Canvas. He's like a sales exec for Canvas. And he was saying, and I actually learned a ton from him, both in that episode and off the record, but he was like, places that already have Canvas or Schoology or, I mean, Google Meet, whatever, any of those learning management systems, but they're already there and everyone already knows how to use it. He's like, they're not missing a beat. Like, they're just ready. He said, you know, yeah, everybody, they're going to fumble here and there, he said, but they have the tools and they make the switch. Places that hadn't adopted that technology or where people hadn't been trained, that's where everything has to stop because you didn't have the tools ready, you know. And then I think what happened is that in a lot of places, when you said, hey, we're going to do online in the fall, everybody remembered back to that rough transition in the spring. You say, but now we've had some time to prepare. Obviously, I think we all would have liked more time to prepare. You know, locally, I think our decisions were made later. I would have loved to have known in July what we were going to do so I could have started preparing. But either way, you know, and right around the end of the first marking period, I was asking students just like, you know, what do you guys think about this? Like, you can tell me I'm doing a terrible job. You wouldn't hurt my feelings because most days I tell myself I did a terrible job just because that makes me better. Like, even on a good day, I focus on what didn't go well. And the kids had this like really interesting insights, but they're like, it's like, we're figuring it out. Like, it's getting better. It's not good, but we're getting better. You know, if we do this for a little while, or if kids had gotten maybe better training on how to use the tools rather than just, hey, load it up and go, there's a lot that could be done here. If you think about this idea of toggling in the future, obviously we, you know, knock on wood, we don't want more pandemics and we don't want weather disasters, everything else. Is this just something that we can have though? Like, can we use these concepts in perpetuity, just on and implement them at any point where we need it, a weather issue, whatever it may be? Is that something that's just going to be built into how we do school after this?
Yeah, I think that moving forward, really, we have the ability to have learning occur anywhere at any time. So, for example, a student could be absent for the day, but sick at home, but they could be working on the work. They have the ability to see the work. Or, for example, if a teacher is unable to go to school for some reason, and not whether they're sick or not, but just say, for example, something happened where they can't be there that day, but they can still teach, they can teach online and have the kids work online. I mean, it's, I think, and also if the student had, I mean, this is where we need to improve is the equity issue with technology and internet connectivity. But I think if we can get that close to as universal as possible, then really we're going to bridge a lot of the divides, I think, in learning, especially as we get better and better using these tools and students get better and better at using these tools, because learning can occur whenever, you know, whether we're, you know, live synchronous or asynchronous at home. They could, you could post like an ed puzzle or just a video just relating to what you did in class. You could record the class and just place it on your learning management system and keep it there for, you know, for a week or for the entire semester, so no one misses out on the class. So, I mean, essentially, I think this is something that is here to stay because it streamlines everything for what we're doing.
Yeah, and I think you hit an important piece in there that a lot of discussions, a lot of times when we talk about equity, I think people immediately make the assumption that we're talking about you know, socioeconomic issues, talking about poor students, or it becomes very quickly in most people's minds, it becomes a race issue. And I think a lot of people, you say equity in schools, and I couldn't generalize and say how many people this is, but I just think anytime I've been in this conversation, all of a sudden everybody starts pulling examples of either the poorest students in their own school, or everybody goes to predominantly Black inner city schools. And not that that's unfair entirely, but there's a ton of rural kids who may or may not have money, but whether they have money or not, they don't have internet. Like, they just don't have it, you know? And so that's one of those infrastructure pieces where if we could treat access to the internet as a public utility, mm-hmm. and maybe do a little bit better job of expanding access. And it is happening, but if we could do that better, then a lot of these other sort of tools and these issues, it's a done deal. You know, if every kid had internet at their house, then a lot of these things could be happening all the time. You know, you point out like the attendance piece. I tease my AP kids this all the time. Like, and really I've made the joke in my like on level academic class, but there the attendance is a little bit spottier for some other reasons, but I'm like, you know, like most of you guys haven't missed a single day. Like a lot of you are having the best attendance you've ever had in school this year, just because you can do class from your bed, you know, which, you know, maybe for some kids is ideal. So for you, thinking about an ideal school, all right, you're immersed in the data and the technology, and you're talking about some things that I'm like, I could do that. And then I feel bad. So I'm like, I don't know if I'm going to do that. Like you're going to turn into my role model by the end of this conversation. If you had your own school to run, and think of it as private or charter, you know, that no holds barred, just the kids can't die and they have to learn something, but you can sort of run it any way you want. What to you would be the ideal school? Is it just using these strategies in the schools we have, or would you do a major overhaul?
I mean, I think that we can't get into the conversation that we can completely change what everyone is doing. But what we can do is provide some of the models and strategies that can be incorporated in their own local jurisdiction that they can use them within their own setting, whether it's charter school, whether it's a predominantly urban school, suburban school, et cetera. So I think just for my ideal model is that if we can provide opportunities for learning to occur anywhere where there's always an internet connection, there's a really diverse learning management system with tools that can engage students, can have them work collaboratively, can have them express themselves. Students can create like a digital portfolio and demonstrate their learning that way, along with what their, you know, a grading system, whether that's standard based or letter grade. To me, that is a step in the right direction. And I don't know whether it's like a blended learning model that is specific to making that all that happen. But I think just those principles for me would be my ideal school at this point moving forward. And I can share that to the world. Teaching practices they're going to be using in a lot of tech, even more of a computer in some respect. If you're building something, you're still going to have to use your smartphone as your banking tool, as really essentially everything that you're using in your life. So I think that to me, that's the direction I would like to go in education.
And, you know, I think as you pointed out and explained very nicely, a lot of that is within our grasps. Like it's stuff that we can do. You know, I keep making the joke that some days I'm teaching and I feel like I'm in an episode of the Jetsons kind of deal. Cause so much of this was, you know, it felt like it was a century away when I was in college. And now I'm like, oh no, it was like 15 years. Like we're doing it right now. And so I think that a lot of the things that you're suggesting we could do with that, and I don't know if there's a right or wrong answer, but for you, do you think if we're implementing some of these strategies, if that blended learning is happening, if we are prepared, say, for the toggle at any moment, et cetera, would you agree or disagree with the idea that students should be able to stay online? Like, in the future, pandemic's gone, mm-hmm. should students still be allowed to stay home and do school? Or is the physical attendance important in other ways, like to you?
So I see the trend going probably two directions. So one is that more urban and suburban schools and even rural schools will have a choice. Probably about 25 to 30% of the population within districts will probably like online or want online to be that predominant option for them. So I think we'll have a lot of districts choosing to have at least an online academy or school within their district that is K through 12, where students have the ability to go online and basically conduct their entire education. And I think that in some schools, it could be more of like, especially the secondary level, more of like a true like hybrid blended learning, maybe a couple days of the week there actually are in person for the entire day, or it's part of the day that they're in person and online. For example, like just having opportunities for them to get more into the community and doing like internships, jobs, et cetera, that would make it a lot more possible and more equitable for students, because they could take maybe like one online class, one in-person class at a high school, and then go and do a job or internship. And then thinking more of like the K-8, I think just having an opportunity to have an online school as well as just the in-person option available for students. I think if districts choose not to do that, they're going to lose a lot of students to these online charter schools, where you can get students from anywhere in the country to participate in this online charter school that is doing an amazing job with implementing technology online and implementing these really good strategies to help student learning. So I think that districts would be bold right now to really start thinking about that before, there could be a consolidation of some of these big schools online, where it could take a lot of these kids that would stay within their districts to this online nationwide or statewide charter school that has really good effective online instruction. We've definitely seen that, I know, in California, for example, with a couple of these big ones. So I think that if actions aren't made by these local districts, they're going to face a problem in the future, where you're going to have about 20 to 25% of your students. They're going to be like, hey, you're not offering it, then I'm going to go somewhere else.
Yeah. Yeah. And that I'm trying to set up to do an episode on school choice, and I'm trying to find, I've got like three people on a list and they're all very busy right now, obviously. So I'm trying to like track down. So just to better understand, like, what are these ideas with choice? But yeah, I think that there's a lot of kids who've gone to homeschooling, and my colleagues are all like, well, they'll all be back next year. And I'm like, 80 or 90% of them will be back next year. Like, some of them went to homeschooling and the families realized they liked it. And you're going to have some kids who got into online school and realized they like that too. And so I think we need to be flexible in the options that we provide, because as you point out, if we don't provide those options, the market will, they're going to find that opportunity somewhere. And if we're doing all the work and all the learning now that would make it possible, we might be squandering an opportunity both for general innovation and maybe for serving those students if we don't continue to provide at least some of these options and opportunities. So before we wrap up, I'm gonna throw you the last sort of two things at the same time here, because I know you have another book to talk about. But as we get close to the end of episodes, I always ask people, is there anything that we missed? Just because sometimes, we're doing a deep dive, but we also covered a lot of ground there. If there's anything that you think we either didn't talk about that we should have, or maybe didn't do service to or justice to, you can, clarify. And then I always ask for a couple of books or movies that you would recommend, and they could be related to education or just for fun. One of the things I know we need to maybe talk for a minute is you have another book that's going to be out soon. So we maybe want to address that. But is there anything in general you want to address? And then what do you recommend?
Yeah. So one thing that I want to talk about for about a couple of minutes more is the concurrent / high flex model. I think that, like you said, in your school district and their districts around the country, I was interviewed for a national story by NBC News, and I've had opportunity to talk to teachers around the country about like specifically like the challenges of this concurrent option. And honestly, it's like without the like really good training and without certain tools, it's like really impossible to do over like long-term periods of time. So I just really do hope that districts really think about what they're doing with this concurrent style. If you're providing absolutely like no training, or if you don't have a tool like Bloxy or Classroom Relay, or there's another one that of these tools where you can see everyone's screens at the same time, monitor their actions, you can record their screens, you can freeze them, you can take a URL and you can place it into their screen for them. Also, you can send them private messages within that application. Like, if you do not have like one of those fundamental tools, like, you're absolutely going into this crazy. It's like something that you should not do. It's not going to be beneficial to the students at all. And it's going to burn out a lot of teachers. And I talk a lot about that in my book. It's like, if you are doing a lot of stuff that you don't have the tools, nor the training to do, it's going to create a lot more burnout. And we're facing already an unprecedented teacher fatigue and burnout rate this year, and it's not going to be good for the profession. So districts are deciding to choose this and not doing it in a way that is strategic or very intelligent, then it needs to really, you need to go back to brainstorming what you need to do before you think about implementing it or doing it at all. So
I'm glad that you said that in strong words, because I'm not going to say some of the, I have a job and all the rest, but I did a short solo podcast where I talked about what the concurrent option was going to be, just because when it started floating around locally, I was looking at, like, I'm in a couple like Facebook groups where it's actually like parents who want to reopen the schools and things like that. And I'm just there. I just want to keep a pulse of, like, what are people thinking? What are the questions that maybe parents have and things like that? And a lot of people were so excited, like, finally my kid's getting back to school. And I was like, yes, but, like, I don't think you understand what this means when they're going back to school.
Yes.
That's actually been, like, one of the most downloaded episodes I've recorded, not because it's the most interesting or had the most, it was because in the local environment, like, people didn't understand. And then they're like, oh crap, this is why. And then apparently, like, a homeowners association sent out my podcast to everyone in their community, just because they're like, no one understands what they're doing. And I'm thinking, like, man, like, I'm not the guy that should do it, because I only, maybe if I'm lucky, I three quarters of the way know what I'm talking about, right? This is a platform or a model of schooling that could work, but I don't know if we're doing all the things we need to up front to make sure it's going to work. So when I tell my students, like, guys, if you're coming into the classroom, just expect that you're going to be in the room with me. You're just going to be doing basically the same online class, just sitting 12 feet away from me or whatever. And I think in an ideal situation, that wouldn't be true. I'd be able to vary it up a little bit more. I just don't know that I have the tools or the time to figure out how to do that, because I don't have extra time. Like, I have to teach class until right up until the day they show up. I don't get 2 weeks off to play with new tools and figure it out, you know? And so I don't know that I'd say no one should do it, but I think I agree that maybe we should be way more cautious about how we do it, if that's the best decision we can make.
I mean, essentially the research in higher ed is that basically the course has already been developed before concurrent even begins. So that's basically the big thing that we need to point out, is that traditional high flex learning that is also characterized somewhat as concurrent. Some people get the definitions. They are a little bit confusing, and there's misnomers with each. But the research has shown that if you don't have an entire class pre-built with the options, like, you have an online option to do this activity versus an in-person option, if you don't have it already built in that course shell, then it's not something that's going to be really effective, because you're not providing those alternative opportunities for the cohorts. And also, you're not providing the opportunities for them to intermingle in a way that's effective or pre-planned. And then thirdly is that in the K-12 environment, there's absolutely no research to this. There's no research. In terms of, like, understanding it from a classroom management perspective, thinking it from a technological, looking at the logistics of looking at a variety of different interfaces for the average teacher, also thinking about building the shell or building the course that is more pre-planned, and you cannot do it day by day. It's something that is just a logistical an instructional nightmare if that occurs. So it's something that is, I just warn everyone when they're thinking about it, just based on just those reasons.
You know, and sometimes I get a little bravado going, and I'm like, I'll figure it out. I'll be good. And in the end, I'll figure it out well enough. But, you know, I think about some teachers where, you know, I'm teaching kids at the end of high school and all the rest. Like, I can't imagine trying to pull this off in seventh grade. You know, like, that's where, if I'm looking at a room full of, you know, college bound students in 11th and 12th grade, they're maybe set up with some basic skills. They have some foundational skills that make this more accessible to them than maybe a seventh grader does.
They have those executive functioning skills, you know, thinking about, like, a K-6. I'm just like, I don't know how it could happen.
It's
at all.
It's And that's, I mean, locally, they're not doing it. The plan is not to do it in elementary school where I work, but middle school and high school, that is the plan. And as you said, you know, the lack of research means that everybody's just kind of guessing how it's going to go. Real quick, so your new book that's going to be out, when is it coming out? But how is this different from or extending the ideas of the first book about navigating the toggle term?
Yeah, so the new book, I'm actually submitting everything to the publisher today. It's basically, it's a standalone, but builds upon a ton of the ideas they discussed in the first book. Just really talking about a lot of how to incorporate these research-based strategies with the EdTech tools in action, also like teaching teachers and school leaders, like what are some good ways or what are some good ways to structure these blended learning sessions, which in online or in-person slash online settings, talking about specifically about professional development and using like Twitter and Facebook as like social media infused pedagogy for building your own learning as a 21st century modern educator. Then there's a chapter about self-care, making sure that you're taking care of yourself during this time and using appropriate strategies there. And then also I've incorporated 13 case studies from teachers across the United States and also a couple school leaders as well, talking about each of the themes discussed in each chapter, but really focusing on their personal experiences of like how they're navigating these themes. So it's really just a lot more content, which is a lot of these really great stories and case studies relating to what's going on, what are some of their best practices. So you can really see at, you know, just at the research level, but also at the practical level and also the experience level of, you know, what's occurring and how you can incorporate those within your classes and schools and districts.
That's awesome. You know, and you're capitalizing on the lived experiences that people have actually had, which is nice too, because, you know, in the first book, there isn't as much, wasn't as much to draw from. And so now, you know, you're in the situation where people have done this, and it's probably a good time to be in education research because there's going to be a whole lot to look at over the next few years, right? Like we've created this opportunity, but in this case, you know, I love that you're using a combination of the research and individual experiences in ways that, you know, should help a lot of people do these things better, because this isn't necessarily going to be over fast. You know, ideally, I think everybody wants to be back in school soon. And we all assume that we'll be back in school next fall, but there's no guarantee that everything's going to be over and ready. You know, there's no guarantee that the 2020 or 2021, 2022 school year will be quote unquote normal. Like there's still likely to be some remnants of this, and even the possibility of having to do some of these shutdowns. So the fact that you're sort of providing some guidance and some ideas to help people out, I think is going to pay dividends. You know, I think, you know, so everybody go out and buy the book, I guess is what I'm saying, man. Go get the book.
Yeah. So it's hopefully coming out in late Q1
okay.
of 2021.
All right. So I'll make sure I'll link that up. I'll get some information from you. I'll put it up on the website, and when it does hit shelves, or, you know, when it is available, I'll do a little promo for you, because I think great ideas, and it's going to be helpful to a lot of people. Outside of your own books, what do you recommend? And it can be teacher stuff, or it can be just for fun, books or movies that you think people should check out.
Oh man, just real quickly about just a show or movie, just The Mandalorian season 2 has just absolutely been just out of this world. Just watched the final episode of season 2 last night, and I was just like totally just there's a twist there at the very end. I'm not gonna give it away, but it
did
was
you cry great. Did you cry? I've only seen a few episodes, like it's
no,
it seems
I didn't
all right,
cry but... it just was a sudden like it was kind of nostalgic, but it was also really cool at the same time.
Yeah, my father-in-law yells at me all the time, because like it's like his favorite show. So anytime we talk to him, he's like, "Are you watching it?" And I'm like, "I saw a couple, I don't know." And then I saw a lot of people you know, online last night who were like, "Oh my gosh, it's first time my wife ever saw me cry." And I'm like, now I feel like I want to go watch the show just to figure out what they're talking about.
Yeah. And then just thinking about books, I mean, obviously the books by Catelyn Tucker have been great over the last number of years. Ditch That Textbook, Matt Miller has been instrumental in that. And then just thinking about some other books as well. I loved reading over the last 12 months Stamped, as well as How to Be an Anti-Racist. Those were great books as well, just to influence just my thoughts and thinking, as well as how I portray, you know, anti-racism in classes as well. So just a wide variety of things, to be honest, and just always trying to read something different. I even read Educated as well, which was a great book as well, that just kind of really brought me to a lot of conclusions. Instead, doesn't, you know, you can be someone that is a good learner, even though if you don't have that traditional schooling experience. And it just kind of like was a great example of that.
Yeah, that one, I like that a lot. I actually wanted to use that in class this year, and they just realigned like reading lists. And I think that went like somehow ninth grade stole all these like great books that would, I think would be better, you know, used for older students. But that was one I both enjoyed the read and thought like, man, that's probably one a lot of teachers a lot of teachers should probably check out, just because I think sometimes we get hung up on this idea that if you're not in school, you're not going to be learning. And as you pointed out, you know, your ideal school is to sort of just provide access to school everywhere. So all of a sudden the physical presence looks optional, you know, and then you read a book like that and you're like, maybe the institution itself is, you know, not that it's bad. It's just, maybe it's not as essential as sometimes we think it is, or at least for some people. And yeah, that one definitely provided for me the change. Not the change wasn't in that, oh, you can learn without school. For me, it was how surprising it was how successful she was in post-secondary school. Like, definitely. I think you cannot go to school and be a fully functional and smart person. The idea that you can all of a sudden hop into the classroom and figure it out, like that was really the surprising thing. And I don't think the average person maybe can pull that off as well, but certainly had to reconsider my thoughts about, you know, what could make you successful in higher ed and how much or how little impact, you know, K-12 would have. All right, so we're going to get ready to wrap this thing up. We've been talking with Dr. Matt Rhodes about navigating the toggle term, his books, and then just general concepts of blended learning, ed tech, and how we can all maybe do a little bit better job of teaching and providing education using the tools available to us. Matt, if people want to get in touch with you, I know you're on Twitter at Matt Rhodes 1990, and it's R-H-O-A-D-S, and I'll link all this, but website, do you have any other accounts?
Yeah, so I have my website and blog, www.matthewrhodes.com. The other podcasts I've been on, you can definitely, I'll link this one, obviously, to my website, and you can listen to it there, along with my other podcasts, and also, I have some demonstrations there as well for PDs that I provided, as well as my active blog. And so it's a lot of resources there if you want to just go check that out.
It's awesome. Yeah. And for all the things that teachers want to learn about or need to learn about, I do think that you've positioned yourself very nicely to be like a man of the moment. And, you know, based on what you're talking about in terms of your goals for using the data and using the tools, I don't think that that's a flash in the pan. So I appreciate all the hard work that you've been doing and the ideas that you're sharing with people, both through your blog, through the books. You know, as I said, you're a great follow on Twitter. You know, I've gotten all kinds of cool ideas in terms of some of the ideas that you have about how we can better handle the pandemic and all of this. So again, we've been talking with Dr. Matt Rhodes, and this has been the ClassCast podcast. If you'd like more information about Dr. Rhodes' books, website, etc., you can check them out directly at matthewrhodes.com. I will also link all of this at classcastpodcast.com. You can find the ClassCast podcast on all major streaming services, including YouTube, Spotify, Pandora, I don't know, all of them, whatever. So this has been a good talk, and I'm going to make sure we get this out right in time before all the schools start trying to get themselves back in the building in January, so that everybody can think about how they will handle what will probably be inevitable toggles of the spring. Matt, thank you for taking the time to talk today.
Yeah, thank you, Ryan. Thanks for having me.